Reckless Nation. Welcome to another State of the Nation episode. David, what are we talking about today? What's the theme?
We are modeling out ultrasound money. We put out the episode with Justin Drake a while ago. So now we are getting Justin Drake back onto the show to get into the granular details of what makes ultrasound money, ultrasound money. There are numbers to discuss. And so we are going to discuss all of them.
There are numbers to discuss. There are models to discuss. There are four different pieces to this. David, you tweeted this out pre-episode, and we're going to get into all of them. 25% staking, ooh, annualized, APY.
In ETH terms? In ETH terms.
ETH supply, maybe it peaks at 121 million and never gets higher than 120 million.
kisses 120 million and comes back down.
Long-term ETH supply target, possibly 100 million. So that's the coming down part. And the potential for sell pressure to be reduced by 90%. Justin Drake has brought the models behind some of those astounding facts that I think very few people have actually looked into. I mean, the first exposure to EIP 1559 and to the merge, the staking merge in a comprehensive way, I feel like was almost the podcast that we did with Justin on Ultrasound Money. Now that was very metaphor driven. That was very high level to help people understand the narrative. Now this is the supporting data. This is the supporting numbers, the supporting financial projections behind all of this. So I'm super excited to dig into this. And David, all-time high ETH, coincidence? I don't know.
I think not, sir. I think it knew it. This episode was coming.
I choose to believe that as well. All right, David, what's new in the community before we get to Justin? Got to talk about badges. If you are a Bankless Premium member, pick up your badge. We've been saying it for 2 weeks. Definitely do it. Pick up your badge. This is the week. We're doing more raffles this week. So check your email for that email from Lucas at banklesshq.com. If you have issues with that, email support at banklesshq.com. Also, David, we've got a killer episode coming up on Monday. You want to just give a taste of what we're going to cover in that episode?
Yeah, this episode makes some very, very bold claims. We like to make bold claims on the Bankless podcast, but this one is brand new. Josh Rosenthal, who is probably a name that most people aren't familiar with, but he is a historian of European art, money, wealth, history. And we make the claim that we are on the cusp of a digital renaissance that is equal to or larger than what the Renaissance that came in the 1400s. And the connections here are in the 1400s, we invented the Gutenberg printing press, thank you, and also double entry bookkeeping. And in the modern day, the printing press is now the modern day internet, and the modern day double entry bookkeeping is blockchain. And that actually is unlocking a brand new renaissance, a crypto renaissance. And he did a fantastic job just going through the history and drawing the parallels. We talk about renaissance meme culture. The meme culture actually started perhaps in the 1400s. We talked about the parallels between Martin Luther and Satoshi. And we talk about what, so cool, so cool. And so there's a lot of awesome through lines here. And it's actually already been one of my favorite episodes to come out of the Bankless Pod.
When we were recording that, David, I had just like goosebumps almost the entire time when Josh was speaking, just talking about these various parallels between the kind of the old Renaissance and this Renaissance. So be sure to check that out, Bankless Nation. As well, David, Dharma is still cooking some things up. They wanted us to let you know that they have now rolled the Dharma app out. They have a direct connection to your bank account in all 50 states in the US. And David, when people ask like me about DeFi, especially my friends who don't know much about them, I'm increasingly pointing them to start with the Dharma app because that is a great onboarding experience. Mm-hmm. Direct from their bank account to DeFi in one tap. Super cool. Anything else you want to say about Dharma?
Yeah, we know retail season is coming and Dharma is probably the best place to send retail who are still looking for like that kind of TradFi experience of like, you know, just good UX, but it's DeFi in the back, right? And so one tap separates you between your dollars in your bank account and ultrasound money on Ethereum.
Ooh, dharma.io, guys. Check that out. Download the app. All right, David, I'm going to ask you the question I ask at the beginning of every State of the Nation. What is the state of the nation today, sir?
The state of the nation, it was going to be bullish, Ryan, but I was
chit-chatting. But we've used that.
Used that before. And I was chit-chatting with Justin before the show, and he asked him for inspiration or ideas about what the state of the nation is. And he said, ultra bullish. And so the state of the nation today is ultra bullish. As you can see, if you go and look at the ETH price chart, and as well, what will be an ultra bullish episode coming to your ears in just a moment.
You know what's crazy, dude? I have two emails waiting for me. One is a 80-page report on a why Ether is sound money, and the other is an institutional report. Mm-hmm. These just came out today. An institutional report, I should say, around Ether as an asset. Ultra bullish that mm-hmm. the narrative is spreading, both in mm-hmm. institutional side and the story of Ether, the asset is spreading among analysts too. So I've got tons of reading to do, but like it's all ultra bullish news.
And it all feeds back to what Justin presented to us the first time around with ultrasound money, right? So much of those reports tie into the ultrasound money thesis. And so, you know, tip of the hat to Justin for really pioneering this message. And I'm absolutely stoked to bring him onto the podcast in here in a second.
This is what Bankless is doing, helping to develop the narrative layer, the meme layer, also helping to spread the education of what these bankless systems are doing in the real world. We're going to get to Justin in just a minute, but before we do, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible. MetaMask is your go-to wallet for the bankless journey. If you're going bankless, you need MetaMask, period. Browser and mobile, get them both. This is your tool to unlock the world of DeFi. Here's my favorite part. Now you can swap tokens directly in MetaMask with a single swipe. This has got to be the easiest way to trade Ethereum tokens. Choose a token you own, a token to exchange it with, and get your quotes. If you like what you see, you hit swap. That's it. What makes swaps so useful is what happens behind the scenes. It compares DEXs, aggregators, and market makers to find you the best price with the lowest network fees and the least slippage. This means you can swap a wider range of tokens, and swaps can even automatically split up your trade to give you access to better liquidity. You don't even have to think about it. Try it out. Download MetaMask for desktop or mobile now at MetaMask.io and start swapping.
Balancer is DeFi's most powerful automated market maker. Typical AMMs just have two tokens inside of one liquidity pool, which can lead to fractured liquidity across the many pairs in DeFi. With Balancer, you can access the full power of multiple tokens inside of one single AMM, which unlocks an entirely new playing field of possibility. This makes Balancer an awesome building block for so many different use cases. Balancer pools can make asset indexes, but instead of paying fees to portfolio managers, Balancer lets you collect fees from traders who use your portfolio for liquidity. Additionally, Balancer smart pools can be programmed to have properties that change according to predetermined rules, such as changing the swap fee based on market conditions, or even liquidity bootstrapping pools, which can help you launch and distribute your token with day one liquidity. At Bankless, we used a liquidity bootstrapping pool to sell our BAP t-shirts to much success. Balancer V2 brings powerful new features that makes your money work even harder for you. In V2, idle tokens are capable of generating yield in DeFi without sacrificing liquidity in the pool. To top things off, Balancer is reimbursing gas costs with BAL rewards, meaning that your gas fees are reimbursed up to the cost of the transaction with the Balancer governance token. Balancer's mission is to become the primary source of liquidity in DeFi by providing the most flexible and powerful platform for asset management and decentralized exchange. Dive into the Balancer pools at pools.balancer.exchange today.
Bankless Nation, welcome back. We have Justin Drake back on the podcast again. This is the third podcast video show recording that we are doing with Justin. He, of course, is an Ethereum researcher. He was on two podcasts with us previously. One is on ultrasound money. The other was on cryptography, both incredibly important episodes for you to listen to and understand part of the Bankless canon. Now, Justin, how are you doing today?
Doing great.
We are excited about this episode, and we're going to be sharing some models that you put together in a few minutes around some of the concepts that we really dove into quite deeply in the Ultrasound Money podcast. We're going to put some like numbers behind some of the concepts we were talking about. But before we do, I feel like we need to maybe ground the audience again in understanding Ether as an asset. And of course, we talked about the properties that are coming online for Ether soon, in particular EIP 1559, which adds a fee burn component, and also the advent of full proof of stake and the shutting off of proof of work. We're calling that the merge. Those are all important concepts in the case for ultrasound money. But there's also another analogy that I think Bankless listeners are familiar with that we want to get into here. And that is the analogy of ETH as a triple point asset that David and I have used so often before. And the concept of ETH as a triple point asset is similar to sort of the states of matter that people might have learned about in, you know, in science. I don't know, seventh grade science, eighth grade science, wherever you learned about that, perhaps lower as well. So, and the concept is that matter can be one of three states. It can be a solid, it can be a liquid, and it can be a gas. And ether as an asset can also be one of three states. It can be a solid, so it can be staked as a capital asset. It can also be liquid, so it can be used as a money. And it can also be used as a gas. So it can be used as a combustible consumption good to purchase ether block space. So that is the triple point asset thesis and the triple point asset model for money, which we have used. And it's kind of cool because it maps very directly to the asset superclasses. Like an asset can either be a capital asset or a money or a commodity, and ether can be all three of those. You have now extended that metaphor a little bit with a new analogy, adding sort of this temperature dimension to ether as a triple point asset. Can we start there? Can we dig into that? So tell us about the temperature analogy you wanted to share with the Bankless community.
Yeah, so I think the temperature metaphor is, as you said, a generalization of the triple point asset. So not only can we look at the individual state of, let's say, water that will represent money, ether, but we can look at more fine-grained temperatures. So, you know, for example, money, you could have money as a long-term investment, which is kept cold in the fridge. So that's kind of cold money. Or you could have hot money, which is, for example, if you're a day trader, or if you're an exchange processing lots of withdrawals and deposits in a hot wallet. And I think the reason why this temperature of money metaphor is useful in the context of ultrasound money is that really there's three big consequences of EIP 1559 and the merge, and they each affect a different state of water. So there's one key innovation that improves the kind of liquid money, as it were. There's one which improves the characteristics of the solid money, and one that improves the characteristics of gas money. And one of the interesting things, I guess, is that, as you say, Ethereum is this unique asset. It's a triple point asset in the sense that, in addition to being this money in this narrow band, you know, between 0 degrees Celsius and 100 degrees Celsius, it's capable of breaking boundaries which were not previously broken. So it can break down the 0 degree and kind of freeze itself, but it can also break down the 100 degree kind of threshold and vaporize. So that, you know, that's the analogy of having gas and literally vaporizing it, just like you would vaporize gasoline when you consume it. It leaves the system into the ether. Looking forward to kind of explain what are these three key changes to the cash flows, right? So in the previous episode, we had the energy metaphor, right? We had energy in the form of electric energy going through the various components. And the reason why I chose the electricity metaphor is because I wanted to focus on the components, right? There was these three components. There was the battery, there was the engine, and there was the solar panel. But here, I really want to focus on the asset and on the cash flows. And as you said, I think this episode is all about modeling the cash flows and understanding how big they are and how they circulate, and what are the consequences maybe for total supply, what are the consequences in terms of cell pressure, et cetera, et cetera.
So Justin, let's hash out this this temperature metaphor just a little bit more. So we have ether as a capital asset, we have ether as a store of value, and we have ether as a transformable consumable asset. How do these map on to the three phases of matter?
Right. So the maybe the easiest one to understand is the solid state, right? So mm-hmm. when you have ether and you lock it, you're essentially freezing it because you're really reducing the velocity of money. You're putting it in deep freeze. And one great example of this is staking in the context of the Beacon Chain, right? It when you want to unstake, there's a defrosting period, if you will.
A thawing period, right.
A thawing period, exactly. Thank you. And you know, we're also seeing this in the context of DeFi, where you have the notion of total value locked, like the locked, the L kind of suggests that there's some freezing going on. You know, it's a spectrum. Like different DeFi applications might have different temperatures. So, for example, you know, Uniswap might be, you know, somewhere maybe close to the freezing point, or you know, just past the freezing point, in the sense that the ether in Uniswap technically can be removed with a single transaction. And actually, if you want to sell ERC20 for ETH, you know, you can do that immediately. But what we've observed kind of on a holistic standpoint is that the collateral is sticky, right? So mm-hmm. we did have things like the vampire attack with SushiSwap, where liquidity would go from one place to another, but it still stayed within the realm of DEXs or the realm of DeFi. If you look at, you know, total value locked on DeFi pools, it just goes up only.
And we also can talk about the metaphor of MakerDAO, right? So like Ether is collateral inside of MakerDAO. And in theory, you know, Ether in MakerDAO is also just one transaction away from becoming liquid on the secondary markets. But when we look at a systems level perspective, MakerDAO has over $3 billion worth of DAI preventing that ether from becoming thawed, right? So that ether in MakerDAO is stuck behind a $3 billion DAI supply that is keeping that ether being used as a cold store of value. It's frozen in its place, right? And so in the ether in MakerDAO, it would be frozen ether, very cold ether, right? Not liquid, not available to the secondary market, and definitely not being burned because it's not being used as transaction money. It's just cold ether, frozen, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, if you place your ether as collateral and you take a DAI loan, for example, to buy a car or to buy a house, right, your income is going to allow you to gradually repay that loan. But, you know, it might take a decade for you to repay your Maker loan. Mm-hmm.
So if we're painting the holistic picture here, right, so we're almost looking at this whole spectrum of like temperature mapping to ether, the asset. And on the far left side of the spectrum, what we're talking about is ether. If we're thinking of ether as like, say, water, it's below 0 degrees Celsius. So it is frozen, but there are degrees of how frozen it can be. And I'm guessing that you might say, Justin, that like the far side, the coldest ether can actually get is when it's staked. Right. Mm-hmm. That is like sort of, it's not slushy. It's not in this in-between area. It's like deep freeze, very cold, locked inside of the staking contract. And maybe Ether locked in DeFi might be a little right to that. So it might be like, you know, negative 10 degrees Celsius mm-hmm. or so, and you know, getting close to the thawing point, something like that.
So actually, you can go even more extreme than staking. So you could, for example, artificially put some sort of time lock on your ETH. You could say, I'm going to lock my ETH for 10 years. I'm going to create a smart contract that does that. That's kind of artificial and no one really does it, but in theory, you could do it. But there's something that does happen naturally, and that's the process of losing coins or accidentally sending them, you know, to the zero address. So that's kind of 0 degrees Kelvin, you know, it's like maximum, you know, negative temperature. And it's interesting because it's, you've taken money and you've made it so cold that you've denatured money. It's no longer money, right? Technically it's a balance somewhere, but it's no longer money. It's denatured because you can't move it anymore. It's frozen forever. And you could say the same thing, for example, for the parity multisig wallet. So there's this very famous bug where there's basically over 500,000 ETH, which is provably at 0 degrees Kelvin. and yeah, it's basically no longer money. And the interesting thing is that when you go at the opposite end of the spectrum, you have very, very similar behavior, because on the hot side of things, on the boiling temperatures, you're basically destroying ETH, you're vaporizing it, and removing it from the supply. So you kind of have this spectrum, and it turns out that on each extremes, you have very similar behaviors. You're basically improving the monetary qualities of Ether, right? Because on the cold side of things, you're kind of taking liquidity, like literally liquid liquidity, and you're kind of freezing it and slowing it down. And on the other hand, you're kind of vaporizing it and having it leave the supply. And this is kind of a geeky kind of math analogy, but you know, I studied mathematics, so I'll share it. So when you do projective geometry, you know, you have a line that goes negative infinity, you know, all the way to on that side and that side. And you introduce this one point called the point at infinity, where basically these two lines meet at the point of infinity. So you can kind of like think of it mm-hmm. as a circle, and kind of the from a monetary standpoint, the two extremes are really the same place. And the interesting thing about Ethereum is that you can think of it as a machine to take this liquid money and push it to the extremes. On the one hand, you're incentivizing this liquid money to become frozen. And on the other hand, you have this other mechanism where you're incentivizing this liquid money to vaporize. And so these are two very strong kind of scarcity engines that will suck out all the liquidity mm-hmm. In its liquid state.
And by vaporize, what you're talking about is essentially literally being burnt through EIP 1559. That's it becoming vaporized, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is what I mean by vaporized.
Justin Drake today brought his own sound effects. was the sound of Ether being vaporized in EIP 1559.
Okay, right, go ahead, Justin.
Yeah, post EIP 1559, every time you make a transaction, you should imagine this sound in your head.
And that's one of three sound effects that we have on standby. And I want to make sure the listeners are up to speed with why we're talking about this temperature metaphor, because we're about to go into Excel sheets and perhaps talk less about metaphors and talk more about numbers. But the metaphor is really, really useful to hold in our brains as we model this thing out, both as a model with numbers, but also a model for understanding these things. And I think what we just finished on right there is a fantastic through line. We have, I'm picturing like a cylinder, like a test tube cylinder, and we have the hot water at the top and we have the frozen water at the bottom, and then the liquid water in the middle, right? And that composes like the Ethereum system as a whole, right? Boiling water up at the top, which is the ether being used as transaction fees, and then some of that being vaporized and leaving the system. And then also we have ether being deep freeze state, you know, in cryo at the very, very bottom, which is ETH locked in DeFi and ETH being staked. And the meta of the through line here is that currently in Ethereum, we have a very, very liquid center. And there's not that much boiling off the top, and there's not that much frozen at the bottom. But that's what is all about to change when we introduce EIP 1559, which really starts to turn on the boiler at the top, and a lot of ether is being vaporized up at the top. And we are also introducing staking, which is freezing a lot of ether at the bottom of the cylinder by incentivizing ether to be locked in the staking contract. And then there's also something to talk about with being locked in DeFi. That's like the slushy ether, the half melted, half not. But what's really changing is that this liquid center, where there is Justin, you've called a fire hose of water being added into the system, which is ether issuance from proof of work, is actually going to be constricted into perhaps just a much more modest garden hose. And that liquid center is actually going to become much smaller in relationship to what is being boiled off the top and what is being frozen down at the bottom. And so this temperature frame of reference is, we're going to come back to this throughout the rest of this episode as we talk about some of these numbers, more explicit numbers, as we model out ultrasound money. Justin, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, so I kind of want to highlight the three cash flows that are, I think, important for this discussion. The first cash flow, you mentioned it, is issuance. So issuance is you have just new liquidity that comes out of the sky. And right now it's a huge amount of issuance. It's like, as you said, it's this fire hose of liquidity. And you know, the market has to bear with it. It's like this huge amount of sell pressure. It's costly to run proof of work. You know, one of the big innovations of proof of stake is what I called economic efficiency in the previous protocol. We're reducing by, let's say, 10x the cost of consensus. So that's cash flow number one, issuance. Cash flow number two is related to this warm side, this hot side of the spectrum, the burning. It's supply. Right, so we have a new mechanism to reduce supply, and this is kind of where ultrasound money meme came from, right? Because we have deflation, but you know, really the ultrasound money is a very holistic meme, you know, with strong fundamentals, with many pillars. You know, this deflation aspect is, you know, just one of them, one which is easy to communicate in this kind of catchphrase. You know, if Bitcoin's sound money, then ETH is ultrasound money. So that's cash flow number two, supply. Cash flow number one was issuance. Now, cash flow number three is basically the ETH as collateral and like how much ETH will be drawn out from this liquid center and kind of frozen. And basically what we have here is when when we have the merge, the transaction fees will be in two parts. One part will be burnt. We've already talked about this, but another part, which is the tip, is not burnt. And that goes directly to the validators. And so that will increase the staking APR. And that's basically going to increase the power of the freezer, right? We're going to go from -5 degrees to -10 degrees, or I guess, you know, the APR could be like the degrees that you're targeting. So we're going to set it, let's say, at -25 degrees, right? So that's a 25% APR. And it's going to be so cold that it's going to like freeze like a lot of the neighboring liquidity. So yeah, these are the three cash flows that we could highlight one by one.
Before we get to all of that, so can we talk about the part that we haven't talked about in depth very much, which is sort of this liquid piece right in the middle. So mm-hmm. We talked about the freeze side, that is staked ETH, frozen ETH, ETH used in collateral. We talked about the burn side, that is it being vaporized by EIP 1559. And of course, we use that analogy of new liquidity is coming into the system via issuance right now. And right now, there's a lot of issuance, like 4.2% or something issuance annualized per year is coming into this squishy middle part. There's not a lot staked and there's nothing being burnt. So we don't have the engine and we don't have the deep freezer. Let's talk about this middle portion, because that's mostly what we mean when we talk about money, right? It's kind of liquid. It can be used as a store of value. It can be used as a medium of exchange. It can be used as a unit of account. It can actually be spent. Is there anything more we need to talk about in this liquid phase, or do we just need to hear the sound effect, Justin? You tell us.
Yeah, I think the sound effect is very important. So let's go ahead.
This is the liquid phase.
Yes. So we have 100 million Ether roughly, which is in this liquid phase. You know, if we remove the 3 million Ether, sorry, 4 million now in the deposit contract and the Ether locked in DeFi. So we have this 100 million pool, which is slushing. And as you said, you know, Ether is used as money. It's used as money in the context of NFTs. It's used as money in the context of trading. It's a unit of liquidity, right? On Uniswap, like 95% of the volume is this is ETH pairs. It's, you know, and one of the interesting things is that you know, this traditional power of being money is what Bitcoin has explored, right? So you can think of Bitcoin as exploring this range from 0 to 100. And with Ethereum, we can really, you know, push the limits, as I mentioned. But Yeah, within this liquid phase, you know, we have all the various use cases for Ethereum, but we have this kind of internality, this externality, I guess, which is that the issuance is this necessary evil that we have to deal with, and it's flooding us, and we're drowning in liquidity at the moment, and this issuance is representing a huge amount of sell pressure. You know, we're talking tens of millions of dollars every day. And so one of the things that one of the things for which we have a spreadsheet is looking at the sell pressure and how much it will be reduced. And we're talking billions of dollars of relief from this sell pressure.
Okay, guys, so that's the metaphor going into the models. And just quick recap, and we'll do it with sound. So right now, Justin, you said there's about 100 million or so of the total supply of ETH. And I don't know the total supply of ETH off the top of my head, 115 million?
115 yes. million, yeah.
Okay, let's say 115 million total supply of ETH right now. 100 million is liquid. What does that sound like? That's our 100 million ETH liquid, the vast majority of it, the bulk. Now, we're starting to get some ETH that's frozen. It's frozen in the staking contract. I'm going to say 6 million or so frozen in the staking contract. We also have some ETH frozen in DeFi, 4 million frozen in the ETH staking contract. Justin's correcting me. We have some ETH in DeFi as well. What does that sound like?
So you sort of imagine like the water becoming ice and
I'm cracking. Imagining that. I'm also imagining my childhood in the cold winters of Canada, just when I hear that. All right. So and we have not yet fired up the furnaces. We have not yet started to burn ETH. But remind us again, what's that going to sound like when we start burning?
Sizzle.
Sizzling on the pan. EIP 1559. Okay. All right. So that is the setup, guys. Let's dive into the numbers. And there are four models that you've put out recently. And I think maybe, Justin, you could give us some context on why you created these models and how you came up with them. But for those that are watching and listening to this, I'm going to quickly go over them at a high level. One, we're going to look at the ETH peak supply model. And you're claiming that ETH peak supply could be 120 million, no more than 121 million ETH ever created.
We're at 120 million, not
120 million. Yes. I keep saying it's the Bitcoiner in me, Justin. 120 million could be ETH peak supply. Right now at 115. So we're going to get into that model. That's model one. Model two is the road actually going backward in time, going back in terms of supply, the road back to 100 million. Because again, we're going to start burning ETH, and we might be able to reduce over the next decade 20% of the total supply of ETH. What's that burning sound again, Justin? Got to hear that burn.
Nice.
And vaporizing.
Going from vaporizing from 120 million to 100 million. That's model two we'll get into. Model three is we'll get into the net buy pressure. So David was talking about we have issuance of about 4.2% that is feeding this fat middle. There's 100 million supply ETH with 4% issuance or so per year. That is getting greatly restricted. So we're going to talk about the implications of sell pressure reduced in Ether on Ethereum by as much as 90%. That's model three. And the last model we're going to talk about is the incentive for individuals and for people who own ETH to freeze their ETH. And that is a staking APY that is getting massively increased to possibly 25%. We'll talk about how that's even possible because it's not coming from issuance. It's coming from transaction fees. And this is the first time I've actually seen transaction fees added to the revenue cash flows that stakers receive. So we're going to go through those four models. Before we do, Justin, is there anything else? Like, why did you come up with these models in the first place? Tee these up for us.
Right. I mean, we've had, you know, these big structural changes with EIP 1559 coming and the merge coming. But I wanted to quantify things. And I think the big story really of the last few months is that we have one kind of mega cash flow, which is the transaction fees. And that's the root of everything, really, because it unlocks, you know, the high APR when you're staking. It unlocks the burn. And, you know, I just wanted to see, okay, what were the numbers, because no one was talking about it. So, you know, one number that I was personally very surprised by was the 25% staking APR. And, you know, we can talk about the consequences there. I guess, you know, in terms of the supply, I, you know, in my original like little graphic for which introduced ultrasound money, I had this projected kind of cap, very conservative cap at 2 to the 27. And, you know, I just like powers of two because you don't have to bike shed too much, you know, like 2 to the 28 was clearly too high. 2 to the 26 was clearly too low. Like 2 to the 27 was the right kind of binary order of magnitude. But people were kind of confused, like, why did he choose 2 to the 27? It's not a good meme number. It's a bit too geeky. So I was like, okay, let's try and refine this, you know, to the closest million. And it turns out we can refine it to the closest 10 million. And, you know, like the spreadsheet kind of suggests that we will never hit 120 million. We'll be able to peak under it. And then basically once we have the merge, the total supply can go down. And then like the reason why I created this other spreadsheet, like the road back down to 100 million ETH is because 100 million is a kind of a nice meme number. And I was wondering, okay, is it actually feasible for us to start at 120 and then go back down to 100 million? And the answer is yes. You know, it might take a decade, it might take 2 decades, but it is definitely possible to have the total supply go back down to 100. And 100 million kind of has a bit of historical significance because Vitalik at some point, you know, had this Reddit post where, you know, he was making projections around the difficulty bomb, and he said, you know, it's possible we'll never hit 100 million. And then, you know, we crossed 100 million, and then all the Bitcoin maxis were like, ha ha, you know, you have no supply cap, infinite supply, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's possible it's kind of like the revenge of the 100 million where we're going back to 100 million. Then the other thing that I actually, that was the very first spreadsheet that I created was around the it was actually in preparation for our previous podcast. So the sell pressure, right? In the previous podcast, I said that EIP-1559 and the merge combined is going to be the equivalent in terms of reducing sell pressure of both the deposit contract and Grayscale combined. So 7.2 million ETH annually, right? So it's like a huge amount of relief in terms of sell pressure that we're going to have from these two kind of economic innovations, sci-fi economics, the EIP-1559 and the merge.
Okay, let's dive into it now then, Justin. This, of course, is the meme brought to life with numbers, with an actual model, a projection of supply and the economic implications, what would happen. Let's go to the first model, which is a spreadsheet that people will find in the show notes. Of course, if you're watching on YouTube, you'll find this in the show notes on YouTube. This is a spreadsheet you put together for a model of ETH peak supply. And the claim in this spreadsheet is pretty simple. There may never be more than 120 million ETH in existence. Ever. Again, it's back to this diagram. We might hit a point where we go ultrasound, we grow ETH supply, and then it might bend back downward. And that point might be 120 million. Can you explain some of the variables behind this scenario and why 120 million is kind of, it's an estimate, of course, but it's almost a conservative estimate as well. Get into this for us.
Absolutely. So, you know, the way that you predict supply is quite easy. Like you look at the supply today, and then you basically add the daily supply. And there's various things that will influence the daily issuance. I mean, that will influence the daily issuance. So right now, the daily issuance is composed of two things. Number one is the proof of work issuance, which is about 13,600. It's actually a little bit below that. So I've put 13,550. And then we have the daily proof of stake issuance, which is, I think, around 800 ETH per day. But I put 1,000 ETH there in the best guess, because that's going to be the average between now and the merge. And then there's these key dates that are right. So the key date number one is, when will EIP 1559 be activated? Because from that point onwards, there's going to be a huge relief in sell pressure, because part of the fees, which will normally go to the miners and be converted into electricity and electricity bills and sold, you know, it's like a forcefully sold, will now instead be burnt and not sold. So right now, the current plan that was announced a few days ago by Tim and the whole crew is 14th of July, 2021. But of course, you know, we could slip, you know, we've slipped many times. And so, you know, my conservative you know, date for EIP 1559 is the 14th of August 2021. And the reason why I've put it there is because we actually have to hard fork. And the reason we have to hard fork is because there's this difficulty bomb, which will stretch the block times. And so it's a necessity. And, you know, at this point in time, the devs have extremely high confidence that, you know, EIP 1559 will go in this fork coming up in London.
So Justin, the variables that really drive the difference between what you're calling the best guess, the more leaning conservative guess, and the conservative guess are the activation date for EIP 1559, which is targeted for July, but could stretch into August, possibly, maybe likely not later. Also, the merge date. So that's the date at which proof of work goes away and proof of stake becomes the consensus engine for the entirety of Ethereum. The proof of work issuance, that's going to not really an assumption. That's pretty like static. That's, you know, right, definitely baked in. Mm-hmm. Daily average POS proof of stake issuance, that could vary some, but that feels pretty secure as an assumption as well. This other one, average daily fee burn. So there's kind of a range on that. On the conservative side, it looks like there's an average fee burn of about 3,000 per day, ETH per day. And right, on the best guess side, it's about 6,000. What are we burning per day right now? Is it closer to 6,000?
Well, right now we're not burning anything.
Excuse me, not burning.
In theory, right.
I meant in transaction fees. Yes.
Right. So the 100 day and 30 day and even 7 day moving average are 12,000 ETH per day. Okay, and then the 365-day moving average, which is like the really conservative one, which spans a very long stretch of time, is at 7,500 ETH per day. But, you know, as I see it, you know, the total amount of transaction fees per day is one of these metrics which is quite volatile, but directionally it's up only. You know, let's say 10,000 ETH per day with a 70%, or let's say 60% fee burn, then that's how you would arrive at the 6,000 ETH per day. Like the conservative one, 3,000 ETH per day, I just don't see how it could go below 3,000 ETH per day, given that we have, you know, 10,000 ETH per day in transaction fees, and there's no way, you know, the fee burn will be 30%.
And then, so Justin, based on these assumptions, we get right, a best guess case where we have about 118, call it million ETH in total supply, max total supply, right? Because at this point in time, it's going to start bending down and we're going to start burning more than we're issuing, right? That's the best guess side of things. If you were a bit more conservative, we get to a number that's closer to 120 million ETH as the max supply.
Absolutely, yeah. And the lean conservative is 119 million. So yeah, I'm expecting we'll peak between 118 million and 120 million. And as you said, from the point of the merge, until kind of the foreseeable future, we will deflate very likely every single day. The supply will go down and down and down. And the reason is that proof of stake is so damn efficient, right? Like you need very, very little issuance to run the proof of stake. And so like even a moderate amount of transaction fees will more than compensate for the issuance.
Justin, it's your belief that after EIP 1559 and the merge, that there's no way that we are not burning more Ether than we are issuing. You seem like you have complete confidence in that.
Yeah, I'm going to say 99% confidence that at the point of the merge, we're going down. And I have high confidence, let's say 95% confidence that for the years to come, you know, let's say 10 years, we're going to be going down pretty much every single day.
Justin, this is a massive narrative buster, because I think a lot of people have heard the narrative that ETH supply is infinite, right? That it has no cap, right? What's the difference between those narratives and what you're showing in the model? Because I think people even hearing this are so used to hearing the narrative being told that like ETH supply is infinite, ETH has no cap whatsoever. ETH will continue to issue more and more into the future. What's the difference between those narratives and what and the model here? Because I think people are still who are hearing this might still have a hard time, I guess, rationalizing the difference here. Because this is not the narrative that is in mainstream. Like few know about this. I'm not sure how many people have actually worked through the numbers and have a model like this in their mind, but it has to be not very many. So can you talk about that?
Right. At any given point in time, the ETH supply is finite and there's always been a constraint on issuance, right? At Genesis, it started at 5 ETH per block and we've gone nothing, you know, we've always respected that constraint. You know, we've gone down, you know, to 3 ETH per block and 2 ETH per block, but you know, we've always been constrained from day one. Now, the claim that ETH has no cap is actually technically correct, and the reason is that, in theory, if there was no fee burn and purely just issuance from proof of stake, we would just grow every single year. Now, it turns out that, with proof of stake, you can cap, you can have a provable cap, which is under a million ETH. You know, the plan right now is to basically cap the rewards beyond 33.5 million ETH staked. So beyond that point, there won't be any more supply, and that represents roughly a 1 million ETH issuance maximum per year. But in practice, what's likely going to happen is that we're going to be burning significantly more than 1 million ETH per year, at least for the foreseeable future. And so in practice, not only are we going to have a finite supply, which is de facto capped, it's not in theory capped, but it's de facto capped. But it's even better than a supply cap. It's a decreasing cap. And this is where the ultrasound, the ultra comes in.
I think what we get to do with this narrative where, you know, many Bitcoin maxis will come and say that Ether has no supply cap. But now with proof of stake and EIP 1559, we get to say, well, there's no supply floor. Like it could just keep on going down. Like it could go in the opposite direction and there's nothing to stop it from going lower.
Equally true, isn't it?
Yeah. There's no supply floor. Fantastic. Yes.
All right. Well, let's go to the second model here. So the first claim was there may never be more than 120 million ETH. Stop saying that. 120 million ETH. And this is the model that kind of shows it. The second claim is, I think, equally interesting, but is also part of the first claim in that the supply might be going down and it might go down as low as 100 million in a relatively short period of time. So walk us through the model where we get to 100 million ETH supply, a decrease of 20 million from 120 million in 12 years' time.
Right. So I was asking myself, can we reach this meme number of 100 million ETH in supply? And basically, there's three key parameters or assumptions that you need to set. The first one is how much ETH is being staked. And here you can take kind of the maximally conservative approach, which is to say, we're going to have the 33.5 million ETH, which is the maximum amount of ETH in terms of issuing rewards. The second assumption is the daily EVM fees in the long term, right? So right now we're roughly order of magnitude, we're at 10,000 ETH per day in transaction fees. Now I mentioned, there's good reasons to believe that the fees, total fees is up only. By the way, when I say total fees, I don't mean the gas price, right? I mean the gas price multiplied by the number of transactions. So, we can have our cake and eat it too, because we can have low gas price and lots of transactions with scalability and have this high daily EVM fees. And then there's this third parameter, which assumption, which will be removed once we have EIP 1559, which is what is the fee burn percentage, right? We're doing 10,000 ETH per day, roughly. How much of that is burnt? Is it 70%, 7,000 ETH per day? Is it more? Is it less? And it turns out that it doesn't really matter too much. The ballpark is correct. If it's slightly more, it's good, because we're deflating faster, we're reducing supply. If it's slightly less, then that's also good, because it means a higher staking APR for the validators, which means more ETH that gets frozen. So either way we win. The really important number, I guess, is this the daily EVM fees long term. And so, like, if we plug in the numbers, you're welcome to plug in your own numbers, but my best guess was we're going to have 30 million ETH stake long term. We're going to have at least 10,000 ETH per day, and we're going to have a fee burn percentage of roughly 70%. And that gives us about 12 years to kind of go down from 120 million ETH down to 100 million. So basically to vaporize 20 million ETH, it will take 12 years.
This best guess of 10,000 ETH being burned per day, that's actually where we currently are in right now in EVM fees. And so not only is that what you're saying your best guess is, but like we've actually already checked that box in theory, according to current Ethereum gas demand. Is that right?
That is correct. The gas market, as I said, can be quite volatile. It depends on things like, what is the activity happening on Ethereum? It depends on what the volatility is of the market. It also depends on competitors. Maybe some new blockchain project comes out there, which is so much better than Ethereum, and all your users migrate away. There's many different factors that will influence the gas market.
Do you know what I find funny is even the critics of Ethereum at this point, a point of critique is never that ETH block space demand will go down. That's never a point of criticism at this point in Ethereum's life cycle. It was maybe 2016, 2017. No one will use DeFi. No one will use smart contracts. Ethereum is a solution in search of a problem. It's not anymore. In fact, their criticisms are the opposite. Gas fees are too high. And that's why Ethereum will lose in the long run is kind of a narrative playing out. So even the critics, don't claim that block space demand is going down. Even they think ETH gas demand is going up. But what this would mean in your best guess case, where we are reducing total supply by 20 million over 12 years, that's an annual supply rate decrease of negative 1.4%, right? So right now we're issuing 4.2%. If this best guess turns out to be true, what you're saying, Justin, is we'd have an annualized decrease of 1.4% in supply. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, that's about right. So every year, the supply would decrease by 1.4%, roughly.
Even the most conservative, can we just maybe walk through that? Even the most conservative side of things, where fee burn percentage is lower. Daily EVM fees are about half of what we're doing right now. And there's a lot of ETH staked locked up. Even that, we're still burning ETH.
Absolutely. We're still deflationary. Even in like this super conservative scenario, we're still burning
more
we're
ETH still
exactly, right.
That's crazy. Okay. All right. So that's the second model is the road to 100 million ETH supply. And you can see how that works out. Fork these, put your own variables in, put your own estimates in. These are all available in the show notes if you'd like to view them and fork them and play with them. This next model I think is really interesting. You said you prepared this model, you know, after you were thinking through the Ultrasound Money podcast. This is a model called net sell pressure reduction. And the way I think about this model is right now we've got sell pressure coming from issuance and coming from transaction fees of about 8.1 million ETH per year. And what you're saying is that that pipe is going to be reduced by a lot. It's going to be reduced post EIP 1559, post merge to about 950K per year, ETH per year. I think that's if you take the daily and you sort of annualize that. So that's like an 88% reduction. So another way to say this is, I think this model is claiming that there's about to be a sell pressure reduction of about 88%. Can you talk through this model with us?
Right. So this goes back to, you know, proof of work being extremely inefficient economically. And so here, we need to look at several things. Number one, we need to look at what is the issuance of proof of work versus proof of stake. And, you know, proof of work is fairly stable. It's 13.6 thousand or 13.5 thousand ETH per day. And then for the proof of stake issuance, I'm assuming, let's say, so this, by the way, this was at merge, right? Right now we have about 4 million ETH staked, and I'm kind of assuming, let's say 20 million ETH stake, which is very conservative. Like there's no way, I don't think, we'll be at 20 million ETH at the point of the merge. But let's assume conservatively that we're at 20 million ETH staked. Then the daily proof of stake issuance will be 2.1 thousand ETH. Now, one of the things you need to look at is the profit margin of proof of work and proof of stake. For proof of work, you have a very small profit margin because almost all the ETH you're forced to sell economically to buy the hardware, to buy the electricity. So let's say that you have a 10% profit margin, but actually after tax, right? You have this income tax after which is about 50%. The 10% becomes 5%. So basically 95% of the ETH that you receive, you're forced to sell. Now, in proof of stake, you have a very different scenario where you don't have the electricity cost, you don't have the hardware cost, you only have the taxes. So your profit margin is 50% and you're only forced to sell the other 50%. And actually, on this point, I kind of want to correct one of the things that I said in my previous podcast. I said in the previous episode that proof of stake is not distributive, right? We were basically claiming that if all the rewards accrue to the validators, to the stakers, but that's actually not correct, because roughly half of your ETH that you receive as a validator, you're gonna have to pay an income tax. In most jurisdictions, you know, income tax is around 50%, and so you have this natural sell pressure, which is a distribution mechanism for proof of stake. Anyway, you plug in all the numbers, and you also include the fee burn, and you go from 22,000 ETH per day in sell pressure, which is an insane amount of sell pressure. We're talking, 2.5K ETH. That's, you know, that's about $50 million per day, which is insane of sell pressure. And we're going to reduce that down by roughly 10X to 5 million ETH per day, which is much more reasonable. And so when you annualize this, it turns out that the sell pressure reduction is the equivalent of the deposit contract, which is around 4 million ETH, and Grayscale holding, the 3.2 million ETH combined. But that's not like a one-time reduction in cell pressure. It's every single year we're going to have, you know, the equivalent of 7.2 million ETH that is not sold on the market. So you can, if you want, you can think of it as buy pressure, 7.2 million ETH per year of buy pressure.
That is insanely cool. And so just to reiterate, like removing sell pressure is the same thing and at the end result of things as adding in new buy pressure. It's basically two sides of the same coin. And what Justin Drake is saying is that by removing the sell pressure of proof of work issuance, and then also removing the sell pressure of EVM fees paid to the validator/miners, what we are able to get out of that is the equivalent of both Grayscale and the deposit contract every single year. And so this is a recyclable mechanism. We get to generate an equivalent amount of buy pressure that Grayscale puts in, and also an equivalent amount of deposit demand that the Beacon Chain staking contract also puts in. And we get to have this year and next year and next year and next year, and until we perhaps even break through that 100 million ether supply floor. You know, there's no floor for ether supply.
I guess going back to the original analogy that we were talking about, David, you mentioned sort of this fire hose,
right,
that is feeding the center with the liquid portion of ETH, and it's just feeding it more and more ETH every year, about 8.1 million ETH supply per year. And that's being reduced by a massive amount. So that's being reduced to about 950K ETH per year. So there's just like an 80 to 90% reduction. We're moving from a fire hose, as you said, to a garden hose of liquidity that is filling that center part, the states of matter, that liquid part of ETH.
And to extrapolate on that as well, right? Like, not only do we go from just a fire hose of ether issuance flooding this like metaphor of this like cylinder of various temperature, where this middle part is just getting injected with just liquidity, like ether selling pressure, but on top of that, we have the top part of this metaphorical cylinder, which is now burning ether, right? It's vaporizing ether. And so that with what is being liquid is being vaporized by EIP 1559. And we also have, and so the liquidity is being dried up that way. And then also we have, on the flip side of things, we have this incentive to stake your ether. And so while this middle section of lukewarm ether, it's very quickly getting vaporized or getting staked. And while it's also not getting resupplied by a bunch of new proof of work issuance, it's only getting resupplied by a very small trickle of proof of stake issuance. And this reminds me, this turns my brain to some sort of like kind of stock to flow analysis, where the center part is the new issuance and it's becoming very, very low. And a lot of that, the total ETH supply is either getting burnt or staked, right? Which is the stock. And so there's very little ether supply that's accessible and liquid, which is actually a security mechanism to Ethereum, because not having too much ether on the secondary markets is a way to protect Ethereum from would-be attackers, because there's not that much ether available to them to purchase on the secondary markets and attack. Justin, did I say anything that tripped you up, or did you like that?
That was amazing. That was fantastic. And one thing I'll mention is that in the stock to flow becomes negative, right? Because we have more. And so that kind of something for the Bitcoiners to wrap around in the current model.
Right.
Massive amount of net sell pressure is reduced. This is crazy. So what are we talking about? A factor of 10 or so of efficiency, that cell price reduction. What's going to happen? Like, when that happens, when EIP 1559 comes around, when the merge happens, all of this net cell pressure is reduced by 80, 90%. Like, what happens?
I wonder what could happen.
I guess we'll find out. Justin, we've got one last model to go through, and then we're going to talk about a few other things. But before we do, Bankless Nation, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible.
Bankless is proud to be supported by Uniswap. Uniswap is a new paradigm in asset exchange infrastructure. Instead of a cumbersome order book system where trades are matched with other humans, Uniswap is an autonomous piece of software on Ethereum, which is what Ryan and I call a money robot. No human counterparties or centralized intermediaries, just autonomous code on Ethereum. Input the token you want to sell and receive the token you want to buy. Something brand new in the Uniswap ecosystem is the Uniswap Grants program is now accepting applications for grants. We have been saying this for a while and we'll say it again. DAOs have money and they are in need of labor. If you think that you have something to contribute to the Uniswap DAO, apply for a grant to Uniswap. Just look at the size of the Uniswap treasury. It's almost $3 billion. This mountain of capital is looking for labor. Do you have something of value to contribute to the Uniswap DAO? No matter how big or small your idea is, you can apply for a uni grant at unigrants.org and help steer Uniswap in the direction that you think it should go. That's exactly what we did to get Uniswap to be a sponsor for Bankless, and you can do the same for your project. Thank you, Uniswap, for sponsoring Bankless. Gemini is the world's most trusted cryptocurrency exchange. I've been a customer of Gemini since I first got into crypto in 2017, and it's been my main exchange of choice to make my crypto buys and sells. Gemini is available in all 50 states and in over 50 countries worldwide, and on Gemini there are markets for over 30 various different crypto assets, including many of the hot DeFi tokens, and it's one of the few exchanges that has liquid DAI markets. Gemini just launched their Earn program, where you can earn up to 7.4% interest on 26 various crypto assets. If you're tired of paying fees in DeFi, or you don't want to worry about DeFi exploits, but you still want to earn interest on your crypto assets, Gemini Earn is the product for you. Another product I'm stoked to get my hands on is the Gemini Crypto-Back Credit Card, which gives you 3% cash back on all of your purchases, but paid to you in your preferred crypto asset. When I get my Gemini credit card, I'm going to make sure that I get my cash back in ETH. So whenever I buy something, I get a little bit of ETH bonus back to me at the same time. You can open up a free account in under 3 minutes at gemini.com/gobankless. And if you trade more than $100 within the first 30 days after sign up, you'll be gifted a free $15 Bitcoin bonus. Check them out at gemini.com/gobankless.
So Justin, I was just about to ask you how you get to a staking APR of 25% under your best guess scenario. Can you walk us through some of the variables here?
Right. So we have three key variables here. Variable number one is how much ETH will they be staked when we merge? Because this 25% is at the point of merge, right? It will get obbed away as more ETH comes in and stakes, but I'm expecting roughly 6 million ETH staked when we merge. And the reason is because we're at 4 million right now. Coinbase is going to add another million. And then, you know, we're going to have maybe another million trickle through. And what's happening is that, right, the APY is gradually reducing, right? So right now we're at roughly, you know, 7.8% APR. But with 6 million ETH, we're only at 6.8% APR. So the incentives are, you know, going down as more ETH stakes comes in. Okay, second assumption is what are the daily EVM fees at merge? And I put 10K. You know, as I mentioned, we're above 10K on the 7-day moving average, on the 30-day moving average, on the 100-day moving average. We're roughly at, you know, 12K. So that seems, you know, relatively safe. But, you know, anything could happen, I guess. And then there's the fee burn percentage, which is one of the things that will be interesting to see when EIP 1559 comes in a few months. But yeah, I put it at 70%. And, you know, I guess, you know, one way to try and estimate it is to look at the slow gas price, right? So the base fee is meant to represent kind of the sustained demand for
the basal level of demand. Yeah,
the basal level, thank you. And so you can use that, and then you can just divide out you can just take that gas price, multiply it by 15 million gas, which is the current gas limit, and then divide it out by the total ETH received in fees in the blocks, and that will be one way to estimate a lower bound on the fee burn, but of course it could be slightly greater than that because the slow gas price might be too conservative.
And so when people were previously discussing like the yields from staking, they would really point out just issuance, and they didn't really people forgot to include the tip, and people forgot to include MEV, maximum extractable value, right? And so when people are seeing this 25% APY, maybe they're getting like sticker shock almost of like how high, like no one thought that staking rewards would be this high because everyone forgot to integrate really high gas fees and really high congestion. Right. And so it has been my takeaway is that like people, not only did we not really understand the large implications of reducing issuance and burning fees, but we also didn't understand the net effect of MEV, maximum extractable value, rewards being paid to ETH stakers and ETH stakers alone.
But this isn't MEV, is it, David? This is just fee. Doesn't include MEV.
MEV is a very broad term, and it includes various things. One of the things that it includes is what I call the native fee, which is the fee that's paid by specifying a gas price in the transaction. But MEV is broader in the sense that there's different ways that you can get paid. For example, Flashbots, what they have is a bundle mechanism where it's basically they provide a gas price of zero Gwei, and instead you have a side channel payment. And the side channel payment happens in the contract, which pays the block proposer, which right now is the miner.
So I guess what I'm saying is, like, I think what you're saying, David, is absolutely true. But what I'm saying is I think Justin's model only includes the protocol specific fee revenue as part of MEV. So if you wanted to include all MEV, it would be even more than this. Is that correct, Justin?
That is correct. But Flashbots have this dashboard, which is currently in beta, and I got the privilege to see it. And from my understanding is that the incremental MEV, which is paid in these bundles, is only about 5% additional. So it's right now, at least, it's relatively small, but you know, things could change. And you know, this daily EVM fees, which is, you know, right now around 10K, that could go down, but you're right, you need to take into account the possible increase in the fees that are paid through Flashbots, because those will go directly. This is pure tip that goes directly to the validators. There's nothing is burnt really in the Flashbots fees.
Earlier in the episode, Justin, you talked about how like the staking ether is so cold that it freezes the ether proximate to it. And I think this is the time to revisit that metaphor. Can you walk us through that metaphor and how this has to do with this 25% APY?
Right. So 25% is clearly, you know, insane and crazy. And it's not going to last long. It's going to be a temporary thing. And so what's going to happen is that more ETH is going to come in and stake. And so the question, the very natural question you might ask is how much ETH is going to come in and stake?
And get frozen.
Exactly. And one way to answer this is using a model. And what you could include as a parameter in your model is what is the fair cost of money of Ether? You know, what is the opportunity cost of staking Ether and as opposed to doing something else with your Ether? And then the other thing you need to model is what is the cost of staking other than the opportunity cost. So there's various other costs. So for example, there's the compute and bandwidth cost, but there's also the risk that you might get slashed. There's some sort of bug. There's also the risk that you go offline and you accumulate these offline penalties. My personal estimate for the cost of staking is roughly 1%. Okay. I might be overestimated, I might be underestimated. That's for you to put in whatever you think is appropriate. And for the cost of money, of the opportunity cost, I would put it roughly at 5%. So let's say a 6%, you know, fair staking APR. Anything over 6% will get arbed away. Now, if you go back to the second spreadsheet, the road to 100 million ETH, you'll see that even when you have 30 million ETH staked in the in this best guess column number E, the staking APR is actually above 6%. So if I'm correct, you know, that 6% is kind of the fair APR that towards which the market will converge, then we're going to see tens of millions, you know, on the order of 30 million ETH staked. So if this road to 100 million comes true, you know, we're going to have roughly 100 million ETH. 30 million of it is going to be in deep cryogenic cold storage. We're going to have some amount locked in DeFi. I don't know. Like, it could, right now it's 11 million ETH, but you know, that's been growing extremely fast. Maybe it could be 20 million, 30 million, 50 million. We don't know. And then the rest, which is going to be probably like a minority, is going to be this liquid ETH, which will be, you know, available to be sold on exchanges and used to fuel kind of this high velocity Ethereum economy.
And so, returning again to the cylinder of ETH at varying temperatures metaphor, we have very little new ether being added, the liquid new ether being added to the middle, and where we've gone from where we are now with 4 million ether locked in the staking contract, that ether is so cold because it's receiving such a high APY from fees and issuance, that 4 million ether is so cold that it's going to freeze perhaps up to 30 million more total ether, right? And then we already have 11 million ether locked in DeFi, perhaps that doubles over the next year to 20 million. All of a sudden we have 50 million ether frozen, right? Either in DeFi or in the staking contract. And that's all but half, like a decent, not half, but 40% of the total supply of ether is frozen, right? Meanwhile, we have on the flip side of things, EIP 1559 burning off a lot of that excess vaporware or water vapor. And then we have only a small, modest garden hose of liquidity being trickled in via new proof of stake issuance. And so that is the complete final like model of this like ether cylinder of varying temperatures.
That is exactly right. So you've summarized it perfectly.
And that is how we model, ladies and gentlemen, ultrasound money.
Wow. Wow, guys. All right. So that's how you got to those numbers, Justin. There may never be more than 120 million ETH. We might, over the next 10 years, decrease that to 100 million ETH. Sell pressure is going to get massively reduced, 80 to 90% with the efficiency of proof of stake. And then staking APY at the start of the merge could be as high as 25%. And then it will decrease from there as more ether is getting cryogenically frozen. That's what these models are showing us. Justin, let's maybe end with this. How soon could all of this happen? I think crypto is the crypto markets and just, you know, crypto natives in general are very used to living these like bull bust cycles and like these almost like these 4 year kind of repeating cycles. And a lot of this maybe stems from Bitcoin being the dominant asset. And there is a halvening every 4 years where Bitcoin supply gets cut in half. So every 4 years, we sort of anticipate something new is going to happen, a changing of the cycles. But I think that EIP 1559 and the merge are going to happen much more quickly at an accelerated rate, and maybe at a rate that, you know, the crypto industry is not typically used to. So how soon could all of this happen? I know we talked about it a little bit, but there's this concept being floated around of the accelerated merge. What is this? How likely are we to hit the merge date and also the EIP 1559 date of July?
Right. So let me talk about the accelerated merge and what it means. Basically, it means that we try to merge as soon as possible, but we have a proof of a MVP, minimal viable product. We remove all the bells and whistles that could slow down the merge. So we remove withdrawals from the Beacon chain back to the EVM. That can wait, you know, a few more months for what we call the post-merge cleanup. We don't enable transfers internally to the Beacon chain. So if you want to transfer some funds from one validator to another, well, you have to wait a little bit more until the post-merge cleanup, because we really want to focus on this minimal merge. And we don't do fancy stuff like statelessness. So statelessness is kind of a sustainability slash security feature, right? We have this massive state, and with statelessness, the validators don't need to store the state, which is very nice. But at merge, we're going to be asking the ETH2 validators to run a full node, a full ETH1 node with all the state. And like in terms of timelines, we've really tried to accelerate things, and that's for several reasons. One reason, as you can see, is that the cash flows are so large, the amounts of money are so extreme that one, this is bad for the environment, right? Because we're just pumping so much carbon in the atmosphere to pay for the electricity bills, you know, on the order of $50 million per day. The other thing is that it's bad for the holders, the ETH holders, right? We have this fire hose of issuance, which is just drowning us in liquidity, which is putting a huge amount of sell pressure. Also, we have miners that have, you know, issued some threats of violence, right? They've said, okay, let's try and show that we're strong and powerful, that we can control the network by, you know, amassing 50% of all the hash rate in a single pool. And, you know, honestly, I think the merge at this point is kind of overdue, right? Like we're 6 years in, right? Like the concept of proof of stake has been there even before the genesis of Ethereum. That was part of the roadmap from day, you know, minus 100. And really it's overdue. I mean, I think this the fact that it took us 6 years really shows how difficult it is to change Ethereum, and how, you know, robust and decentralized, and how much due diligence we put in, and how we want to do things properly as opposed to doing things fast. But you know, the Beacon Chain is now running with over $10 billion. Like, there's a lot at stake. It's been running essentially fine since Genesis. And I think if we were to merge, let's say in December, the Beacon Chain would be a 1 year old. So, you know, we'd have a lot of value at stake for a long period of time. That's quite a bit of, you know, stress testing before we merge. So if you go to the ETH peak supply spreadsheets, I actually have the best case, lean conservative, and conservative scenarios. So my best guess is that we're going to merge the 1st of December 2021. And now the reason I picked this date is because it's the first anniversary of the Beacon Chain, which was launched on the 1st of December 2020. But of course, you know, I kind of lean optimistic in general. So maybe, you know, like people are like, generally in the team, there's this rough consensus at this point that we want to merge as soon as possible, and that 2021 is a good development target, but it's not, you know, an ultimatum. It's not something that we must deliver. We really want to focus on security first and foremost, because we don't want to put the whole Ethereum economy, hundreds of billions of dollars, on a Beacon Chain, which is not secure, and we don't want to risk all this value. So if we have to, we will delay, but because the merge is so minimal, it's so simple from a technical perspective, as far as I know, no one believes that the merge would come after Q1 2022. And so that's why I put my conservative timeline at the 31st of March 2022 for the merge.
And Justin, this would be that accelerated merge. And then, of course, cleanup would need to occur afterwards, correct?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. And then the EIP 1559 date, that feels like it's pretty strong, pretty set. July 14th is looking like the very likely date, but your conservative guess on that was August 2021.
Right. So, you know, there's extremely high confidence from the person leading this effort that EIP 1559 will be part of London, like 99% plus confidence. It's happening. All the implementations are there. We have the test nets. It's already, you know, the EIP has been accepted. Like the real question is timing, But we're talking about weeks. That's the uncertainty period. And as I mentioned, we have this difficulty bomb, which is a forcing function. So we have to hard fork, and we will hard fork with EIP-1559. The question is just, are we going to hard fork in July, August, and potentially in the extreme case, early September, but no later than September 2021.
So back to the acceleration that I was talking about when I asked this question, I don't think the crypto market is used to this amount of issuance supply chain change in such an accelerated period of time. First of all, the amounts are massive, right? Going from like 4% to -1%, like, and then also the timeline is greatly accelerated. We're talking about 9 months, maybe 12 months under the more conservative scenario. So I think that the crypto market, crypto investors, crypto people in general are going to have to get their heads wrapped around this accelerated timeline and the ramifications and implications of what you just laid out. And, you know, thanks for putting the models together for us. I think David's got one last piece he wants to cover, and then we'll let you go, Justin.
And Ryan, you can stop sharing your screen just to finish these things off. Justin, I want to finish off with, again, another metaphor or kind of like vantage point for viewing Ethereum and moving forward. And you've talked about Mach when it comes to ultrasound money. Like if we were at Mach 1, Ether is supersonic and we are actually burning more Ether than we are issuing, but Mach can go up. Like we can hit Mach 2, which is twice the speed of sound, but what does that mean for Ether the asset? If Ether the asset hits Mach 2, what does that mean? Does that mean, is that actually an explicit thing?
Yeah, so Mach 1 means that the fee burn exactly matches the issuance. So it's like as if we had a cap, right? The supply would not increase. It would be very similar economics to Bitcoin, and we'd be like sound money if we reach Mach 1. But if we reach Mach 2, what that means is that the amount that we're burning is twice as much than the amount that we're issuing. Now, by the way, this is long-term Mach 1, Mach 2, Mach 3. If we were to look right now in the present day, it's more like Mach 10. And the reason it's so high is because there's relatively little ETH that's being staked, only 4 million ETH. And so the proof of stake issuance is quite a bit lower. So this little diagram is actually assuming 20 million ETH, which is a far cry from the current 4 million ETH. So, you know, I tried to be conservative. But, you know, as you can see, you know, the 365-day moving average is at 7.5 thousand ETH per day. And the 300-day and the 100-day moving average are at Mach 4, which is 12,000 ETH per day. So these data points at the top there, they're like, acting like magnets, right, for the 365-day moving average. So we can expect that this moving average will keep on going up, cross Mach 3, and possibly even cross Mach 4.
I think this metaphor will do a really good job of kind of explaining the differences between the Bitcoin strategy versus the Ethereum strategy. Because with Bitcoin, we have the halvenings, right? It's every 4 years, it's programmed into the protocol. It's a very ceremonious time for Bitcoiners. It's like, it's just like the time of the halvening. It's the time for all Bitcoiners get to come and celebrate the halvening of the supply making its way to the secondary market. But with Ethereum, I think we could have our own mocks, like, and we get to have Mach 2, Mach 3, Mach 4. And the difference is that with Bitcoin, it's programmed into the protocol, regardless of whether Bitcoin is ready for it or not. It is getting cut in half no matter what, regardless of whether the economics stand up. And Bitcoin is very much hoping that because of the halvening, it makes the economics stand up. But for better or for worse, the halvening is happening. With mocks, with Ethereum and going from Mach 1 to Mach 2, Mach 3, it's not programmed. It's not guaranteed. Ethereum has to earn it. Ethereum has to viably leveraging the just a native economy that's built on top of Ethereum. If it gets from Mach 1 to Mach 2 and then Mach 2 to Mach 3, it's because it earned it. It's because it made the economics work out like that. And so rather than having it programmed and imposed upon the system, the machining, or going from Mach 1 to Mach 2, Mach 3, gets to be a new a ceremonious time for Ethereum people when we don't know it's coming or not. And when we finally hit like Mach 17 or whatever, and we get to rejoice in this new machining. We need to figure out a better meme for this, but a new Mach level where we get to be pat ourselves on the back. We like, we earned this. Like we got this done. Like it came to us rather than it being imposed upon the protocol. Ethereum was ready to reach this new speed of ultrasound money. That's my takeaway that I think is a nice juxtaposition.
Absolutely. And I think this kind of shows the potential of the ultrasound money meme. Like really the whole thing started as a joke, right? It was supersonic money from Vitalik. And then it was upgraded from joke to meme with ultrasound one word. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we're moving towards ultrasound money with a space in between as becoming reality, becoming fundamentals. And as you say, these fundamentals are going to age like fine wine, right? Because if this up only thesis is correct in terms of the total transactions fees per day, this theme is just going to keep on maturing and maturing and maturing. And actually, if you want to facilitate the maturing process, not only can you participate, of course, on Ethereum and be part of the economy and pay these transaction fees, but this is a small plug. I'm looking for a website designer, back end and front end, to help with the website ultrasound.money. Right. So I think there's a lot of potential there to show like really nice graphics of, you know, the daily burn and what Mac level we're at and et cetera, et cetera.
Wow, that is a very prestigious position. I think whoever ends up landing that job to help build out that website, that would be a pretty cool job to land for sure.
Justin, thank you so much for spending time with us. This is number three. And, you know, wow. Like you've just given us so much in terms of understanding what's happening with the crypto economics of this system we call Ethereum. And we just really appreciate you spending the time to do this.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great fun.
Bankless listeners, in the show notes, there will be some action items for you. And one of those is to review these models, the models that we went through with Justin. Super important. Play with them yourselves. If you want to adjust the assumptions, go do that. Give us your feedback. Also, listen to the Ultrasound Money episode again. I've had a lot of Bankless listeners tell us that they've had to listen to it not once, but twice, or you know, sometimes three or four times to fully digest and understand that episode. I think that's a key precursor episode to this one. And I'll just say that I think this is the most important thing happening in crypto right now. And it doesn't get
enough. Since the beginning, in my opinion.
Yeah, but like especially right now, because it's going to happen over the next 9 to 12 months. It's going to happen so quickly. And Ethereum is the second largest crypto network, maybe moving into the first largest as a result of all of this. And people need to understand ETH's monetary policy, ETH's issuance schedule, what's happening with ETH 2.0, the fee burn, the implications of that, the merge, the reduction of supply implications of that. And so we're trying to bring that information out to them. This is alpha. This is understanding. This is where Ethereum is going. So thanks for tuning in. Thanks for tuning with us. As always, risks and disclaimers. Of course, ETH is risky. Crypto is risky. So are these DeFi systems. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we are glad you are with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.